From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. The topic of education here in Idaho has been front and center in the news lately. From the University of Idaho Phoenix purchase deal to the West Bonner School District controversy, all the way to budgets and bonds. So we wanted to take a deep dive into what's happening in Idaho education. So we invited Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with the Idaho Education News, to join us today. Kevin, it's always good to have you on the program.
Hi, Gemma.
So, Kevin, I want to start the conversation today by talking about the University of Idaho's planned purchase of the University of Phoenix. Because on Friday, you wrote about a letter that Governor Brad Little wrote to some U.S. senators. I think it's fair to say the letter was a little bit snarky, Kevin. So tell us about this latest controversy.
There has been a lot of mail going back and forth about the University of Phoenix purchase over the past 10 days. It actually began a week ago on Monday. Three U.S. senators, Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, former presidential candidate. A lot of listeners might recall her from that. And Richard Blumenthal, who's a Democrat from Connecticut. They all wrote C. Scott Green, the president of the University of Idaho, urging him to back away from the deal. Now, I wrote about this last week. Senator Durbin has been active on the cause of for-profit education, and especially the University of Phoenix. He's been a vocal critic of for-profit schools, including Phoenix, for years. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not surprising that he weighed in. What's been surprising, maybe to some degree, has been the response that we've seen to that letter. President Green wrote back to the senators a couple of days later. They had asked him to respond and to answer some questions that they had. And Green's response was pretty measured. I think he tried to address the questions that the senators raised. It was, like I said, it was a fairly measured letter. He didn't raise a whole lot of new issues. I didn't read a whole lot of new in Green's response. A lot of it was what he has said before. A lot of it is what the university has posted on its FAQ page about this purchase. So nothing really new there. Brad Little's response on Friday really did kind of surprise me a little bit, just because of the tone of it. Mm-hmm. He said the three senators really just ought to do their jobs and worry about things like the border and worry about things like passing a budget that will allow the government to continue to function. A little bit maybe out of character for Governor Little, for him to step into the fray with, you know, as you say, as much snark as he did.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, though, Kevin, I mean, these three U.S. senators brought up this point. They contend that if this sale goes through, the University of Idaho would be on the hook for these student loan write-offs. And they say, you know, similar to what happened to the University of Arizona. So can you talk a little bit about that? What is this student loan write-off? I mean, because we're talking millions and millions of dollars in this. And these senators are saying, as I mentioned, they've already seen this happen in one case.
Yeah, that's potentially a really big deal. It's something we had heard a little bit about, but this letter from the three senators really put a sharper point on this. The issue comes, and again, this is a federal issue, so you would expect U.S. senators to have a dog in this fight. If the federal government decides to write off bad loans involving these for-profit universities, the buyer of these universities could be on the hook for the write-offs. And this appears to be happening in Arizona. University of Arizona purchased a for-profit university, or they partnered with a nonprofit university. I don't know if they actually purchased it a couple of years ago. The word now is that U of Arizona could be on the hook for $72 million worth of bad loans involving former students from their online affiliate. So this is not a new development, but it's a development that's taken on kind of a sharper tone just out of that letter from the senators. President Green has said there is some potential exposure. He has downplayed the potential exposure for U of I. He has said that it might be on the order of a few million dollars per year. You start talking about $72 million, that's a lot of money. And even if this deal goes through and the University of Idaho gets about $200 million cash on the barrelhead from University of Phoenix, potentially that money could have to go towards writing off these bad loans. That's the contention the senators are making. And I thought that was an interesting sidelight of this whole thing last week.
Oh, well, and they go on to say that they, and I'm quoting this from the letter from these three senators, is, quote, "There's a pattern of predatory and abusive behavior from the University of Phoenix." And these senators also say that if the deal goes through, University of Phoenix will basically be off the hook, and they'll be able to get around all of these federal financial aid laws. I mean, what exactly does that mean, Kevin?
Yeah. Again, another federal issue here. We're talking about the GI Bill, and we're talking about financial aid for veterans. The GI Bill has been this huge federal program to help veterans for years. And University of Phoenix, this was really interesting. This is something I discovered in the research this week. And I have to credit USA Today reported this back in March. University of Phoenix has been the largest recipient of GI Bill aid through their students over the past several years, the largest of any university in the country. And this is where it starts to get a little bit wonky, but basically for-profit universities have limits on how much federal money they can take in. The idea being the federal government does not want these universities to be wholly funded by Uncle Sam. So they have some limitations as to how much federal money they can take, how much GI Bill money can go through the universities. The contention the senators make in their letter is, well, if University of Phoenix is no longer a for-profit university, they no longer have that restriction, so they can all of a sudden take in even more federal money in the form of GI Bill financial aid. Scott Green says, well, I don't think that that's what the University of Phoenix is trying to do here. We think there are safeguards in place. This is not an end around federal regulations. It's not a roundabout way to try to to exploit veteran students.
So I do want to get into what University of Idaho president said in response to this letter. But before we get to that response, let's talk a little bit about Senator Jim Risch, because he responded to these three other senators, basically saying similar to what the governor said.
Yeah, Senator Risch came out a little bit earlier than Lil and it was basically along the same lines, that this is an Idaho decision and senators from three other states should not butt into an Idaho decision. You know, never mind that University of Phoenix is a national education brand. I don't know how many students University of Phoenix has from Illinois, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. I would venture to say probably a few, at least. So there's definitely a stake here. And you know, this is kind of the thing about this University of Idaho acquisition is, you know, supporters of it have said, this is going to put U of Idaho in a national discussion about education reform. U of I will suddenly become a national player in reinventing education and partnering with an online institution of the magnitude of University of Phoenix. Well, if you want to be a national player, all of a sudden you get national attention. So you shouldn't be terribly surprised that a purchase of this magnitude with such far-reaching implications would all of a sudden get the attention of U.S. senators, including, like I said before, Senator Richard Durbin, who has been a critic of University of Phoenix for years. I mean, if anything, it's surprising it took him this long to weigh in on the sale.
So, Kevin, I only have about 2 minutes until I have to go to a quick break. So I'm curious to know the response from President Green to these three senators, because was he able to sway any of them in his response?
You know, that'll remain to be seen. I would kind of doubt it. I think that the senators have, you know, really deep-seated concerns about for-profit education in general, Phoenix in particular. And I think that's part of what you saw in the back and forth between the senators and President Scott Green and Governor Little to an extent as well. Green and Little both talk about this is a different University of Phoenix. This is we're trying to think forward about how to work with a partner here and how to work with how to take advantage of the infrastructure that Phoenix has created to deliver education online. Now, they're saying, look, we're looking forward. We're not dwelling upon Phoenix's past. And Phoenix's past is definitely checkered. There's no question about that. And I think that past really flavors what the senators are concerned about any public institution partnering with the University of Phoenix, that U of I is risking not only its financial health, but it's also risking its reputation. Mm-hmm.
So at this point, though, Kevin, even with all of this latest controversy, the deal is moving forward.
Right. And the thing to watch most closely, it really has nothing to do with what the senators wrote. It really has nothing to do with what Governor Little wrote back. The things to watch now in the next few months are the accrediting bodies. Phoenix's accreditor and the U of I's accreditor. Both of those bodies have to approve this sale for it to go through. So that's really what to watch. You know, how do those two accrediting bodies view this this transaction? And then, you know, come January, it'll be interesting to see what sort of feedback we see from the legislature. Legislators at the state level some have raised some really serious questions and some thoughtful questions about this transaction. I'll be very curious to see how much of an issue this is come January when Scott Green spends a lot of time at the State House, as do all of the university presidents.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting time for sure. The State Board of Education has denied Brendan Durst's request for an emergency certificate that would let him hold the job of superintendent of the West Bonner School District, with the board saying it did not have the legal authority to give out such a certificate. However, Durst says that decision came after the board gave out three such certificates in the recent past. He goes on to say turning him down was a, quote, discriminatory act, unquote, and he says the board has political axe to grind. Well, the Attorney General's office has weighed in on that controversy as well. So let's find out more as we get back to our conversation about the state of education here in Idaho with Kevin Richert, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. So Kevin, take us back to the beginning on this one, okay? For folks who aren't familiar, who is Brendan Durst and why does he actually need a piece of paper to become superintendent?
Yeah, so like, you know, 23 years ago when this began this summer, you know, it's been such a long story. But anyway, Brendan Durst has a long history, as you allude to. Former state legislator, Democratic state legislator from Southeast Boise, later went on to switch parties, left the state, came back to Idaho, ran for state superintendent back in 2022, ran as a hard right conservative and really courted the hardline conservatives in the Republican Party and finished second in the primary to now state superintendent Debbie Critchfield. Along the way, Durst took a job at the Idaho Freedom Foundation. He worked there for a few months. Fast forward to this summer when the West Bonner School District appointed Durst as their next superintendent, even though Brendan Durst has never really worked in a public school district. He doesn't have an educational background. He has more of a political background. And that is where the State Board of Education comes into the fray. That's where this question of qualifications and certification comes into play. It has been a long summer of watching this story unfold in this relatively small school district in North Idaho. And it has a lot of implications, not just for West Bonner. It kind of gives you a glimpse into local school politics as it's unfolded in that one district as we head into another round of school board elections all over the state. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating story because I think it's a case study of what can happen sometimes with local school politics.
So Kevin, if I'm hearing you right, Brendan Durst has basically zero educational background from a professional standpoint, yet he gets appointed to this position of superintendent. Now, I bring this up because the State Board of Education has given out certificates before, three times in the last 8 years, right? For similar, similar situations or not?
They have awarded emergency certifications for superintendents in the past, for administrators in the past. And that's the crux of the debate here. Mm-hmm. Is why did the State Board do it in those cases? Why have they decided not to do this in Brendan Durst's case? And That's where the Attorney General's office comes into the fray last week. The Attorney General's office issued, I'm not sure if it is a full-blown opinion as much as it was. They gave advice to the board that, well, you really probably can't do that. And you probably shouldn't have done it in the first place in the past. So that is kind of where it stands right now. The state board is, presumably going to, stick with its decision to not award Durst the go-ahead to be a superintendent. And I should point out that here's another place where it gets complicated. This does not necessarily mean that Durst is out of a job. What it does mean is that if the West Bonner District insists on having Durst on the payroll, they literally have to figure out how to pay him with local money. They can't use state dollars to pay Durst's six-figure salary if he were to stay on as superintendent. It's a very convoluted situation. And, as it unfolded last week with the state board's decision, with the Attorney General weighing in, I don't know what really happens next. I was talking to an education source earlier today who asked me, what do you think happens up there? And I was like, I don't know. Let's talk about, ask me something I do know, because this is one I do not know how this unfolds, because on top of everything else, what's going on with Durst, the school board itself is in turmoil.
Oh, it's right. So, okay. So here the Attorney General weighs in, saying to the State Board of Education, you should not have given out these three emergency certificates. Now, why, though, did the State Board of Ed turn Durst down? Because they have given these out before.
And that's where Durst's claim of being politically targeted comes into play. There's no secret that the State Board, let's remember where the State Board members come from. There are eight members on the State Board. Seven are appointed by the governor. And I want to say that almost all of them at this point now are Brad Little appointees. There may be, I'm going through the roster.
Doing the mental math,
I think there are some that predate Little's election in 2018. But the body, the majority of that State Board is appointees from Governor Little. The eighth member of the State Board is Debbie Critchfield, the state superintendent. She gets an automatic seat on the State Board as the elected state superintendent. So that's where you get the political intrigue here, where, Durst is saying that this is really, that's where the board has a political axe to grind, and Critchfield, personally has an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm. And after the AG came out with what they said about you should not have done this to the state board, the State Board of Education is now saying, Kevin, what they will no longer give out certificates like this, correct?
Right. I think that's where they're going to go from here. And that's really only one. That's only one venue where this is all unfolding. Mm-hmm. It's still going to be really interesting to see what happens up in West Bonner with that school board. Because let's remember, back in August, a couple of weeks ago, two of the five trustees were recalled. Very rare to have a recall election succeed. Mm-hmm. This one succeeded overwhelmingly. Voters kicked out two of the three trustees who voted to hire Brandon Durst in the first place. So now you've got three trustees in office. Two of the three didn't want to hire Durst in the first place. So the balance of power within a school board has shifted. It makes me wonder, what, if anything, does the board do about Durst's situation up there? I mean, there are, again, only three trustees in office. They have to appoint two other trustees to replace the trustees who were recalled. When that happens, who they appoint, hard to say. No movement has happened there yet. And the remaining three trustees, they're all on the ballot in November. Oh. So who knows what the lineup on the school board is going to be and how that lineup might affect Durst's future up there.
Okay. So, Kevin, right now, Brandon Durst, is he or is he not the superintendent? And if he is not the superintendent, West Bonner does not have a superintendent on top of, as you just mentioned, three out of five trustees.
He is the superintendent.
Okay.
He may have to be paid locally for that job, but he is the superintendent. He's not been terminated at this point.
Okay.
So, yeah, he's still up there.
So there's a meeting, correct? There's a West Bonner school board meeting set for tomorrow, Wednesday. Any idea what's on the agenda? I mean, I would assume maybe starting to figure out at least how they fill these two school board trustee positions.
Well, yeah, and luckily for us, we have a reporter in North Idaho, Darren Savan, who has been covering this, who's done a great job of keeping on top of all the plot twists. He will be at the board meeting on Wednesday night. I want to say that this is the first meeting of the trustees, the three remaining trustees, and only the three remaining trustees. I think this is their first meeting since the recall and since the recall went into effect. So, again, stay tuned. We'll see what happens Wednesday night, and whatever happens Wednesday night is probably not the last chapter of this saga.
So, Kevin, before we wrap up this topic, can we talk about any feedback or reaction from parents up in West Bonner? Because even though it is a historically conservative area, the uproar in a lot of ways really started with this grassroots effort from parents on both sides of the aisle who were frankly appalled that a non-educator was placed in this position of superintendent.
Yeah, and again, I want to give a shout out to Darren up there. He has spent a lot of time cultivating sources in that community, and he has spoken to some of the parents who are involved in that recall. He's working on a story that we should have in the not too distant future, talking about what got them involved. And I think that's what's so interesting about this, Gemma. I mean, we've got school board elections all over the state in November. Not Boise. Boise's weird. They do their elections in September. But just about every other district in the state has vacancies on the school board that will be settled in elections. Now, some districts may not be able to find candidates, and some districts shall have candidates running on posts. It happens all the time. But I think you're going to see some heated school board elections around the state, because we saw some of that in 2021. I'd expect to see another round of that in 2023. Who knows what happens in West Bonner, because they've got contested elections. But I would keep my eye on Coeur d'Alene, another district where school politics has become very heated. I would keep an eye on some of the districts in our part of the state. Caldwell is one that jumps out. We are trying to compile all of the candidates and all of the contested races around the state. It's 115 school districts, so it's taking us some time. Bear with us. We're going to get that all put together for readers. I think school elections this fall are going to be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So we just had several school bond and levy elections, plus a lot more on the ballot last November, which also included a big one in Pocatello, as well as a $29 million supplemental levy in Nampa. Also, Idaho's top education official wants more money for her budget, and public colleges and universities want more cash so they can pay the bills. So what's coming up on the ballot, and what kind of education budget requests will we see during Idaho's next legislative session that starts in January? And let's go back to our conversation with Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, about the state of education here in Idaho. And Kevin, I think I misspoke. I meant to say coming up on the ballot in November. These things have not happened yet. It's been a long week. Okay, so yeah. Kevin, let's start with the bonds and the levies. What's on the ballot come November?
Yeah, so there are a couple of elections that we know of, bond and levy elections for school ballots, school ballot measures in November. The big one is in Pocatello. You remember what happened in the spring.
Yeah.
The fire at Highland High School. Voters will decide in November on a $45 million bond issue that is designed to replace the fire damaged Highland High School, and well, not replace it per se, but renovate and upgrade the high school. So that's a pretty big request. But closer to home, you've got supplemental levies coming up in Nampa and Middleton. Nampa's is a pretty big one. It's almost $30 million over 2 years to help pay for salaries, to help pay for school technology, to pay for sports complexes. And this is what I think we're going to see more of. I think you're going to see more of these elections in November and in May, because if you remember last legislative session, the legislature consolidated the school election calendar. So schools can no longer run bond issues and levy proposals in March. That had been their most popular date to run bond issues and supplemental levy elections. Can't do that anymore. They took that election date away. Mm-hmm. Schools really have only three choices now. They can run an election in November, they can run one in May, or they can run one in August. And we did see a few in August. So November is going to be an interesting date, not just because of the school board elections we talked about in the previous segment, but in places like Pocatello and Nampa and Middleton. It'll be interesting to see what happens with these ballot measures.
So, Kevin, any idea on how voters/taxpayers are swaying on any of these? Do we have any signs if folks are for or against any of these measures coming up on the ballot?
Well, back in August, most of the ballot measures passed. I'm going back in my memory. I think there was one that failed, but I think there were several that passed. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Pocatello because, you know, that community has been through a lot since April. Those students have been through a lot. But getting a bond issue passed is still difficult, no matter what the circumstances. You need that two-thirds supermajority to pass any kind of a bond issue, whether it's a school bond or a jail bond or what have you. Two-thirds, it's tough to get that kind of a majority for anything. And, yeah. You've got a November election. I don't know what kind of school board elections they'll have in Pocatello. I don't know if they have contested races. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the ballot yet. You'll also have city elections in Pocatello. So you'll have, you know, races for municipal seats. It'll be a really interesting election to watch, especially, like I say, considering what that district has been going through the past 5 months.
So let's talk about Debbie Critchfield, Idaho's Superintendent of Public Instruction, because she's looking for more money as well, Kevin, and she wants this for her public schools budget. So what is she looking for from lawmakers?
What I thought was most interesting in her budget request when she submitted it a couple of weeks ago, she's asking for $92 million this year, in this year's budget.
Oh.
It would free up, it's not new money, this is where it gets complicated. It's money that's already in the budget, but right now it's kind of on hold. It's kind of in savings or, you know, in escrow as best as the best way maybe to describe it. It's money that the legislature did appropriate, but it can't really go out to schools right now because the money is being sent out with a funding formula that is based on student attendance and not on enrollment. Attendance numbers are lower than enrollment numbers. So it does affect what kind of money goes out to the schools. What Critchfield is asking the legislature to do is basically to free up this $92 million, get it back out into the schools to replace the money that would have gone out had the state continued to use an enrollment-based funding model like the state has been doing since the onset of the pandemic. We had this enrollment model in place for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Most school officials, they like it, and not just because it means more money. I think they like it because it's more predictable. They feel like it more accurately reflects their operating costs. Anyway, state got away from the enrollment-based model. They went back to an attendance-based model, which had been in place for decades before. So this is really, it sounds really wonky, but uh-huh. It's a really important debate that's going on right now at the State House about how we fund schools and what sort of model do we use and what sort of incentive do we put in place to encourage schools to, and you know, to really, you know, work on attendance rates, to really work on addressing chronic absenteeism. Everybody agrees kids need to be in school and it's better for them to be in school and certainly better for them to be in school learning than to be chronically yeah. absent. So I think a lot of the push to go back to an attendance-based model is because folks like Governor Little believe that, you know, you really need to give schools an incentive and give them a push to make sure that they're trying to get kids back in the classroom.
Sorry to cut you off, Kevin, but so we won't know though if she gets this approval until the legislature goes back into session in January.
Right. Yeah. It's a supplemental request. So we'll see what Governor Little does with it, whether he recommends it or not. And ultimately it'll be the legislature's call. That's something they will probably take up fairly early in the session because, like I say, it's money for this current mm-hmm. budget year we're right in the middle of, and it goes through June 30th. So for that money to do the schools much good, if it's going to go out there at all, it should go out quickly. So expect that to come up really early in the legislative session.
Well, and Superintendent Critchfield isn't the only one asking for money from the legislature. We have Idaho's public colleges and universities. So, Kevin, they're also wanting some cash.
Again, the universities and the colleges had to do their budget requests by September 1st. Every state agency does. That's why we can find out what they want. That's how we could find out what Superintendent Critchfield wants for public schools. What they're pushing for, the colleges and universities, is money largely to address inflation and largely to address employee salaries. The state does not fully fund pay raises at the colleges and universities. They expect the colleges and universities to come up with some of that money for raises out of tuition and fees. So what the colleges and universities are pushing for is money from the state to pick up the slack so they don't have to put the pressure on students and parents to pick up some of the cost of pay raises. I think all of the colleges and universities are saying, look, we're really trying to increase employee pay. We're really worried about turnover. We're really worried about retention. You know, we're not keeping up with wages in our communities, so we're losing employees to jobs, you know, off campus, outside of the university community. So it'll be interesting to see how that is received by the legislature, whether there will be additional funding that the legislature provides.
Well,
especially for employees.
Well, and in particular, Kevin, I mean, there was a real battle of wills. I mean, almost a war in a way with some higher educational institutions this last session with legislators. So I'm assuming that's going to play into this as well.
Yeah, higher ed budgeting right now and the higher ed budget debate is much more emotional. You know, there isn't as much of an emotional debate over K-12 funding.
Right.
I mean, there is some really serious disagreements about, you know, enrollment-based funding versus attendance-based funding. But as you can imagine, when we're talking about terms like that, it's pretty technical. It's pretty arcane. It's not very emotional. When it comes to higher ed funding right now in the state, it is an emotional debate. Now, it is all tied up in this whole debate about the politics of higher education and funding for programs that, you know, critical legislators will say, you know, advances, you know, social justice or wokeism, you know, you name your term. That has so much permeated the debate over higher education funding that I wonder if that, I don't wonder. I think it probably will flavor the debate over whether the state should kick in more money for employee pay raises.
So, Kevin, with just my last couple of minutes left, can we talk a little bit about possibly seeing school choice come up in the session? Again, came up last time. We have this group called Empowering Parents. You know, they basically want school choice, and it comes down to even giving private schools, giving parents money to send their children to private schools. Where are we in this debate and the likelihood of seeing something like this coming up in the legislature? And I'm only giving you 2 minutes to answer.
No, we had a very interesting development on this just last week. So you have a parental advisory group working on the Empowering Parents program. And let's remember that Empowering Parents is not a school choice program right now. What it really does is provide money for parents if they want to have some money to spend on a laptop for their kids or for better internet, out-of-pocket educational expenses. This advisory panel has been spending the summer trying to figure out how to shape that program going forward. Do you provide money for school camps? Do you provide money for classes and, you know, school uniforms and that? But the big question really comes down to, do you want to expand this program to provide money for tuition or fees for private school? The Parental Advisory Committee last week voted that they don't want to see that happen. They want it to continue to be a microgrant program for computers and internet and maybe other things, but not for tuition and fees to private education. There was a bill in the legislature last year that would have done just that. It passed the Senate. It didn't get considered in the House. I'm sure we're going to see another variation of this bill in 2024. So I thought it was interesting that this parental group came out last week and said, yeah, we don't really want to go down that road.
Well, I think it speaks volumes where a lot of parents are, right? Even maybe parents with kids in private schools and how they feel about this. So I am very curious to see what happens this next session, Kevin, and appreciate all of your perspective on this.
No, anytime. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about this because believe it or not, it's only 4 months until the legislature.
I know. We're counting down already. Come January, we will be talking a lot more. We've been speaking with Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, talking about some of the education issues that are facing our state as we head into the 2024 legislative session. As Kevin said, it is only 4 months away. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.